It's always nice to get a clap before you actually start. Okay, where are we? I set my starter. Okay, so I'm glad that the two previous speakers have spoken a lot about housing, because I'm not going to speak much about housing. I'm going to talk about design, and I'm going to talk about designers and what we can do to try and hopefully put a bit of confidence into people that there are practicing engineers, architects, even contractors, dare I say, and manufacturers who are trying to tackle this at the coalface in physical reality, so that people can actually, and nature can actually use the products, and hopefully in a better way than we have done in the last 150 years, let's say, during the Industrial Revolution. So our task is basically to turn the, we call it degenerative curve, where we're raiding the planet for a little bit more than it can sustain, and turn that curve upwards so we become net positive in terms of the outcomes. And I like Jennifer's outcomes as part of the expression of what she was trying to do. So systems integration. It is not very well integrated at the moment. And so this is a slide from a study done by University of Cambridge, which I chaired their industrial steering group for this project, which one of the little pieces of work they did was look at, if you designed a building in a city center, 10,000 square meter building, and used the four codes for ventilation, space planning, fire, and structures to work out how many people could occupy that building, you got wildly different numbers. So ventilation would allow you to put 3,000 people in the building, space planning 3,750, fire 7,500, although that may now go down after Grenfell. But in structural engineers, over-designed the building to the point that 85,500 people can go in there. Those are all, and all of those professionals would think they're doing a perfectly good job, and they're completely not integrated. It's absolutely crazy. And the reason for that is something called bounded rationality. So bounded rationality is putting a complicated subject into a bounded box, which makes it sufficiently well contained and under control, a bit like a naughty pet, that you can actually study it and test yourself on it and then hopefully qualify in it and become a professional. But the problem is all those boxes, so there might be mechanical engineering, structural engineering, architecture, economics, all sorts of things, biodiversity of one sort or another, but the boxes are not connected together. So the task that we've set ourselves is really to join all those boxes together. So the systems integration of those boxes, and also the arrows point outwards because it's things which are we don't know about yet, or that we haven't even thought about including, are the ones that we need to incorporate in this. And so as time has gone by, the world has become more complicated, and there have become more and more boxes with more and more specialisms, and the whole pile of boxes has become more and more unstable to the point that it frequently threatens to topple over. And even if you put regenerative design and time and biodiversity and all those things into it. So I think a much better way of tackling it is to layer the systems over each other in a way, and this is a slide, this on the right-hand side is from Ian McHarg, who wrote a book called Design with Nature in 1969, set up a design consultancy on the back of it, and his whole piece was to look at not just the physical systems that interacted at a place, but also things like crime, poverty, well-being, health, and those sorts of things, and try to tease together or tease out the connections between those systems in a way that enables, as a effectively landscape and architecture practice, that they wanted to try to do something where they weren't conflicting with the systems, but they were actually supporting them and trying to encourage their development or their co-development. Connecting things together. So this is AREP we all work for AREPs at one point or another. Everybody does, I think. So, but I worked on the Millennium Bridge of infamy. And but the slide on the top right-hand corner is a prediction that was made in 1999. Of the number of people who would go from the north of the river to the south of the river. So the more intense the color, the more people are moving. And on the right-hand side is the prediction of what would happen if we built a bridge between St. Paul's and the south bank of the river. And the prediction was 4 million people a year would use the Millennium Bridge. Actually, 8 million people a year are using the Millennium Bridge, and there's every chance that might go up. The bridge has a design life of 120 years. So over its life, that is a billion people going to use that bridge. And a billion people making connections, a billion people going to work, a billion people not using cars or other forms of fossil fuel-powered transport, joining communities together, and all that sort of thing. So it's a small, it's actually a very small project to have that impact. But there, that's what we are able to do if we manage to choose our projects wisely. And I wanted to put this up, and it was. It goes back to what was being said earlier. So with the 1851 Commission, Alison Nimmo and I are both commissioners with the 1851 Commission, and we are co-chairing something called South Kensen Plus, which is South Kensington, Albertopolis, basically. All the 23 institutions at Albertopolis, so all the museums, Imperial College, and all everybody, trying to do a neighbourhood scale net zero, circular economy, sustainable transport, and nature positive project all together. And we've been doing it for 3 years so far, and we're making significant strides. One of the first things we've done, though, is to, as was mentioned earlier, you need data in order to know whether you're making any strides at all. So the first thing we've done is emissions data for all of the institutions, which we're now tracking. So a lot of them didn't know how they sat relative to good practice or best practice. We're doing biodiversity surveys this year, so to get a benchmark for biodiversity through the whole thing, from the park down to the new garden at the National Natural History Museum. You can read a lot more about it, but the point I'm making is that all of those institutions have chosen to participate in that at a very senior level, and they give an awful lot of time up to work together because they realize they can do more together than they would have done separately. And one of the things they're doing is a sustainable procurement charter, so they can actually buy goods and services which come from organizations which have a sustainable supply chain, which also is cheaper because they have economies of scale. So very good. Natural design, I've called it that. Just by way of saying, so this is a 30-year-old project. I did do this at IRAPS, this is the world's first green skyscraper, which you might say is a tautology, probably. But it's naturally ventilated, naturally lit. It is broken down into little villages, village communities within the building of about 60 people, which is a good social size. And it reduced the operational energy of the building by about 40 to 50% compared to conventional fossil fuel buildings at the time. And it had 12 weather stations, so it was semi-intelligent in terms of the way it responded to the external environment. And it even learned by people's behavior about opening the naturally ventilated windows whether or not it was doing well or badly relative to the outside temperature. That sort of technology has been around for donkey's years, and we don't have it. You mentioned the 1930s semi-detached house. It doesn't have much of that technology in it today, but we easily could have, of course. And an even more simple one, the American Air Museum, which is another project we did about that time, is two very thin concrete shells which act like a massive thermal buffer, like being inside a cathedral in the summer. So if it's a hot day outside, you're cooler inside because the building itself acts as a thermal store to keep to balance out daytime and nighttime temperatures. And it's also naturally lit, has almost no active heating, cooling, or dehumidification, and almost no lighting during daytime. So this is naturally lit interior of a 90-meter span space without any lights on. Lean design, which is, so use what you need and no more, is a thing which people do not do, as we can see from the codes of practice, for example, but also because a lot of technologists put a bit of a sleep at night factor in, especially in the built environment, because they're it's a commercial business. People don't have time, let's say, to iterate their designs as much as they would like to, if I'm being charitable. So they tend to over-design. And again, the Micon study at Cambridge found that they were over-designing by their own admission by about 25 to 30%, which is rather scary. So lean design, we did the velodrome for the Olympics, and it uses, these are principles which are going to go back thousands of years. We use the geometry of the building, or the geometry of the structure, to make it act efficiently. So the roof is like a wet tennis, an old-fashioned wooden tennis racket, which is warped when it's raining. So you get double curvature, which makes it unbelievably stiff and strong and very light. And the walls of the seating bowl are doubly curved, and they act as a stiff structure, a bit like a coracle or a boat. So that we won that competition, built the velodrome. It's, by most reckonings, the most sustainable project on the Olympic Park. But certainly the roof is super, super, super light. And as I say, it was put up without... it's basically 36-millimeter cables spanning 130 meters in both directions because of that double curvature. Adaptive design. So how do you take what you already have and adapt it at a scale which is more than just houses, but the community, the city? This is Stuart Brand, from Stuart Brand's book, How Buildings Learn, which is a fantastic book. But he basically layers the lifetime of the parts of projects according to whether it's the site, which lasts a long time, and it goes through the skin, the structure, and eventually the stuff, which are the things like this, which you get rid of and change every few years. And there's an increasing awareness now. So Vinted apparently is the most the clothing recycling organization is the largest fashion retailer in France at the moment now, compared to any new. So there's an increasing interest in recycling, repurposing, including repurposing buildings like this one we did in Baker Street, which saved 13,000 tons of carbon. That's equivalent to roughly 13,000 trips to the States by jet. We did the same thing, something similar in Barcelona. And I wanted to put this in, which is a project we're doing now with Lower Thames Crossing, or at least we're trying to do with Lower Thames Crossing, which is to use not to use new steel, but to use steel which has been taken from old buildings and is then repurposed to turn itself from a building into a bridge. I want to put something in about folly, because there's a lot of design follies around. This one is 1,907 feet tall in Oklahoma. It's the tallest skyscraper in the United States, and this is it. 24. If you compare building a building like that to building a low-rise building, it's 24 times the amount of material. For the columns and for the stability structure that you'd have for a low-rise building. So, and it's not... why? It's surrounded by 10-story buildings or less. Absolutely crazy. And on the same day that that was published, there was a note in the Evening Standard that said 600 more London skyscrapers to transform the city skyline. And right next to it shows how much... let's say, inconsistency and, let's say, lack of knowledge there is. Right next to it, the Evening Standard had put a note saying, not only are there going to be 600 more London skyscrapers, which are really, really carbon heavy, but the flood wall, Thames Barrier flood walls, and the Thames Barrier and the flood walls are going to have to rise because global warming is making sea levels rise, and we're all going to sink. Anyway, I could go on forever. The last thing. My aspiration when you're designing things is to say, if you imagine you're trying to put something into a state of equilibrium, whoops, and I'm trying to put my phone into equilibrium, if I keep on having to push it, I have to use energy and a system to make it stable, because it's unstable when it's standing up. If I hang it downwards and I move it, it's stable. So we should be designing things which are... set themselves into a naturally stable equilibrium and not force ourselves to do something which is naturally unstable, which requires a lot of energy and support infrastructure in order to keep it into its equilibrium position, because that is very, very inefficient. Right. And that's...